All right, welcome everyone. Certainly a lovely day today. Spring has sprung, that's for sure. And we're all very grateful to see the winter months behind us. Now, of course, as you would know, as most people would know, we've been working through the book of Hosea. And we're up to Hosea chapter 12. And a bit of a difference this morning. We've got Linda on presentation this morning. She's going to do something there. I don't know what it is. But it could be a Who Am I? Something like that. And we're also very lucky to have a guest pianist here this morning in the band. Teresa, standing in for Tim, because some people are off going to the snow. Anyway, let's get started this morning and get warmed up, and we'll sing a couple of songs. So if we can have the singers and the worship band up, we'll start with the Days of Elijah.
Thank you, Ben. Yes, if you'd all like to stand up, we'll sing The Days of Elijah. It's always a favourite. Sadly, we were missing one of our main actioners. Anna. So the next one that we have is Shout to the Lord.
Lovely to hear all the voices out there this morning. Certainly great to sing us some of the songs we know all so well. Managed to even slip in there, Shout to the Lord, which is a favourite song of mine. So, you know, that's what you get. Well, as per usual, we have a presentation first. And so I'll ask Linda to come up and she can do a... show us what she's got here this morning. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you, Ben. So this morning I'm just doing a Who Am I, and hopefully nobody's peeked or gotten a look into what I've who I've chosen. So this particular character in the Bible is quite relevant to Hosea 12 and also Hosea in general. It's not Hosea though. So, who am I? My story is similar to my grandfather's. Joshua is one of my descendants. My descendants led the 10 northern tribes in the revolt against Rehoboam. Yes, Caleb.
None.
Who? None. Not none. It is somebody even further back than that. I was given one of Jacob's blessings. Ephraim it is. Yes. I was Joseph's younger son. I am Ephraim. Yep. So, of course, Ephraim is mentioned a lot in Hosea. And I guess we can wonder why. This is a depiction of him. I don't know what it's based on, but anyway. He is the second born son to Joseph and Asenath, which was the daughter of Potipharah that Joseph married in Egypt. His name means fruitful, and Joseph said, "For God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction," and that was whilst he was made a governor over all the land and bringing in lots of crops for the famine to come. And they, both Ephraim and Manasseh, were given a blessing by Jacob. So as opposed to all the other tribes of Israel, they were the sons of Jacob. With Ephraim and Manasseh, Jacob blessed both of them. And Ephraim actually ended up getting the bigger blessing, even though he was the younger. When Jacob went to bless them, he put his right hand on, Ephraim's head and his left hand on Manasseh's head. And Joseph tried to swap it over because he said this is the older one, so you should give the bigger blessing to him. But Jacob said, no, I want to give the bigger blessing to Ephraim because he will be superior to his brother. Interestingly, Reuben, who was Jacob's firstborn son, he actually had his birthright as firstborn taken away from him because he went with Bilhah, which was Rachel's maid. So they say he defiled his father's bed, so therefore he was stripped of his birthright. He still got a blessing, but and he was still a tribe of Israel, but his firstborn right was taken from him. And so we can kind of take from this that perhaps Ephraim received that right of the firstborn because Jacob meant to give the two sons of Joseph a double portion of blessing. So that's kind of a bit of an idea. And you can see throughout the history of Israel that Ephraim did indeed end up doing a lot of leading. So just a recap on the 12 tribes of Israel, or where they were located. So we have Ephraim actually in the middle, beside Dan, and Benjamin below. So they were very central. It was also a very good place for crops and fertility. I don't know what the significance is of the ox as his banner, but I just put it in there because that seemed to be what it was. So there were many important geographical landmarks within the region. There was Shiloh, which had the tabernacle there for a long time. And then Bethel, which was named the House of God or the Hill of God, which also housed the tabernacle at one point. And they did go to inquire there of God a few times. Unfortunately, later on, when Ephraim turned away from
God, the leaders put calves, or Jeroboam put set up idols of calves there. So it was a bit horrible. And then Shechem was also located there, and that was where Abraham made his first covenant with God. And then, and it was a prosperous, fertile hill country. So Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim, actually led the 10 tribes of Israel to revolt against Rehoboam, which was the son of Solomon. And that's when they split up and became the northern kingdom and then Judah, separate with Benjamin. And he was, Rehoboam was... Jeroboam was an Ephraimite. So there was many Ephraimite leaders. Joshua was a good Ephraimite leader who led the Israelites into the Promised Land, and King Ahab was an example of a bad one. There were a few more bad kings from Ephraim that led Israel in idolatry and sinful practices. In Psalms, it actually says that God rejected Ephraim and gave the blessings to Judah. And you can see this by the Ark of the Covenant was removed from Shiloh to Zion, and David was selected as a king. That was even before Ephraim sort of rose to power. There's a bit of foreshadowing that Ephraim was... stripped of his blessings. Then the northern kingdom was conquered by the Assyrians in 721 BC, and thus, you know, that's when Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim, was lost. So why does Hosea reference Ephraim so much? And indeed, often it does talk about Ephraim in place of Israel, sort of as a bit of a broad term. And I drew from it that the three main points were that it was the leading tribe of the northern kingdom. A lot of the kings were from Ephraim. And it housed the royal family were like the capital. Samaria was in Ephraim, so the royal family were located in Ephraim. And then, of course, the fact that they were given the birthright by Jacob is also another factor, I think. So what can we learn from Ephraim? Well, in terms of Jacob's blessing to Ephraim, that it's not necessarily the oldest that gets the biggest blessing. Have to be worthy of it. And with Ephraim and Judah, that only those who are worthy and obey God will retain the blessings and leadership. So if you're trying to exalt yourself without God's blessing, then you will fall. So that's the main thing that I got out of Ephraim.
Wow. That's great, Linda. Actually, it's very, very relevant, as Linda said, to the book of Hosea, because quite often Ephraim is referenced. And as Linda said, in place of the northern kingdom or Israel, the great, you know, the or the northern tribes, I guess you could say. And that's actually perfect, Linda, for what we're wanting to do this morning, because straight off the bat this morning, Ephraim is actually mentioned. So there you go. Now, we'll start this morning, I think, by repeating the Lord's Prayer. So if you'd all like to bow your heads, I'll repeat the Lord's Prayer from Luke chapter 11. Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, as in heaven so in earth. Give us day by day our daily bread, and forgive us our sins, for we also forgive everyone that is indebted to us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. So, the book of Hosea. Now, for those who haven't been following the series and who may not have spent a lot of time in Hosea, which is probably most of us before we started looking at this fairly heavily, the book of Hosea is an amazing book. Quite often the minor prophets are well known for being very gloom and doom. It's all destruction and warnings and all of this sort of stuff. And Hosea's got plenty of that too, which is, you know, which is reassuring, because otherwise we'd think we weren't in the minor prophets. But one of the most amazing things, I think, about the book of Hosea is that almost every chapter, I'd like to say, has sure, it has the destruction in there, it has the warnings in there and all of that sort of thing, but it has this sort of turnaround point in almost every chapter where God turns around and says, and yet I am your God and I will draw you back. I will draw you unto me. And I think that's a really, you know, it's a really wonderful book like that. And the story of Hosea and what we know about Hosea is that Hosea was asked to take a prostitute as his wife, you know, just to show how unfaithful God's people, or, you know, the Israelites had been to him. And that relationship was really broken down. And that was done, as we saw, through king after king after king in the northern kingdom, in the land of Israel, just turning their back on God and directing the people to go and worship these Baals and Ashtaroths and things like that. Probably not so much Ashtaroth, but the these other gods in the and which they had set up instead of the Lord as their king. So this morning what we're going to do is we're going to work through this chapter, and then there's only about one verse in there that is something that you can really get a message out of. So I've included some other ones as well, so don't worry, we won't miss out. Let's start this morning, Hosea chapter 12. Now, Ephraim, what do you know, Linda? There you go, see? And so we all know from Linda's presentation that when it's talking about Ephraim here, it's talking about the northern kingdom. It's talking about in the divided kingdom of Israel, where you have Judah and Benjamin off at the south, and then you have the northern 10 tribes that followed Jeroboam in the great rebellion against Rehoboam, who occupy the north. This is known as Ephraim. Ephraim feedeth on wind and followeth after the east wind. He daily increaseth lies and desolation, and they do make a covenant with the Assyrians, and oil is carried into Egypt. Now, it's interesting here that Ephraim feedeth on wind. Now, the Hebrew word for that is ruach, and which is actually, sure, it's wind, but it's also breath, mind, and spirit. And it's almost like Ephraim is following after the evil ways of things. And we'll see a bit further on as it goes through that this becomes more apparent. Their hearts have turned from God, and they're not following his spirit. They're following their own or even Satan. Interestingly, the east wind that is mentioned here is Kadim, which is very specific. It's a destructive wind. In the Middle East, of course, you have the winds which come in from the great landmass off to the east. And that's all, it's usually very hot, and it basically destroys the crops, and they reckon they blame it on all sorts of ill feeling and all sorts of things like that. So the east wind is a destructive wind here. So Ephraim follows destruction as well. Now, it's got a colon here, see, and which means that it's going to explain what it means here. He daily increaseth lies and desolation. So this is the way they treat each other. And they do make a covenant with the Assyrians, and oil is carried into Egypt. Assyria and Egypt were major powers in their region at the time of Hosea. The Assyrians, as we know, came in and conquered Israel, the northern kingdoms of Israel there, not long after Hosea was writing all this down, basically, or preaching this. And so, but as we saw, like when the Israelites entered the land, they were instructed to not make a covenant with those people around them, were they? And they weren't to give them the increase of the land which God had given them, you know. So you see here that it's not just in the way they treat each other, but the way they relate to all of the nations around them as well, that is wrong, basically. The Lord hath also a controversy with Judah, and will punish Jacob according to his ways. According to his doings will he recompense him. Now, Judah, of course, is the southern kingdom. Doesn't actually say much about that, but I thought it was interesting to note that when it's talking about the controversy here, perhaps he's alluding to the fact that Judah's heart isn't quite right either. They are actually, you know, they're perhaps following the ways of God. They're perhaps doing everything according to the letter of the law, but he's still got something against them. You know, remember the time in Jesus' time, how he had the Pharisees. They were, many of them, including Paul or Saul, was perfect according to the law, and yet they completely missed it when Jesus came, when the Messiah came, because their heart wasn't right. But it's interesting here that it mentions Jacob. And this chapter, believe it or not, has a lot to say about Jacob, has a lot to talk about when it comes to Jacob. So we'll go and we'll see what it has to... It actually goes on and recounts all of the major events that's in his life coming up in these next couple of verses. He took his brother by the heel in the womb. So he took Esau. Remember, Jacob was a twin. His twin brother, Esau. And Esau was actually the eldest by birth. But we see that God actually chose Jacob. He took his brother by the heel in the womb, and by his strength he had power with God. Now, Romans summarizes the selection here quite nicely, I think, in Romans 9. Jacob is chosen, and yet it says that Jacob was chosen even before the children were born, before they had the opportunity to do the right or the wrong thing. And it goes on and has this big discourse in Romans 9 about, how is there righteousness with God if he doesn't reward people according to their works and things like that. And I think the point here is summarized very nicely in Romans 9, where it says, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. I mean, I think it comes down to the fact that at the end of the day, we're all convicted or convinced of sin, I guess you could say. You know, and the thing is that God will be the one who will actually first revive us, but then will also choose who it is that he's got picked out for his special purposes. Let's keep going, verse 4. Yea, he had power over the angel and prevailed. So, of course, he's referencing Jacob wrestling with the angel. Now, that was... Jacob wrestled with the angel actually at a very interesting time. Actually, I'll keep reading because it does tie in with the next bit. He wept and made supplication unto him. And that was when Jacob returned to Esau. And this was the same time that he had the wrestling with the angel. So Genesis 34, that's recorded in. And Jacob's prayer, I guess you could say, to God at this point includes a very interesting thing here. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. We find in Jacob a very humble person. And I think that what we're going to see here is that Hosea is comparing Jacob with the way Ephraim has turned out, with the way that the Israelites have turned out. And instead of the humility and seeking after God's mercy, they're trying to establish their own ways, their own good, I guess you could say, which never works. Let's keep going. In verse 4, he found him in Bethel, and there he spake with us. Now, interestingly, Bethel, of course, was known as a regarded place, I guess you could say, or a high place, a place where it was one of the resting places of the tabernacle, as Linda said, and also a place that people would go and seek God. And it's interesting because this is where Jacob just camped out one night, and he didn't know it was anywhere special, and he, of course, had the dream and the vision of the ladder to heaven and the angels going up and down the ladder. And he says, at that point, he says, even this is the gate of heaven where I am at this point. So he found him in Bethel. And the promise is actually renewed, interestingly, to Jacob in this chapter where he sees the vision of the ladder. Because God says to him, and in thee and thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And we know that that was the same promise that was given to Abraham, which is kind of really interesting. And we know that it actually says, through you is going to come the Savior of the world, through your lineage. And of course, we know that that's Jesus. But I think the summary for this section is in verse 5. Even the Lord God of hosts, the Lord is his memorial. So Jacob had a relationship with God which was both humble and unshakable, I think, as well. You know, and so the thing which really saved Jacob, which was important to God, was the fact that he remembered God, he loved God, and he knew God. And that's about the best thing that we can do. Now, there's only 14 verses in this chapter, just so you know, so we're going through it rather slowly. Okay, it's all right. I've dedicated a whole page to one verse here. But it's a good verse. Therefore, turn thou to thy God, keep mercy and judgment, and wait on thy God continually. Now, when I read that, I thought, this is exactly what's being said in Micah, in Micah 6 verse 8, where it says, he hath showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. And that should be our prayer, to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. And we can see that this beautifully marries in with some of the elements of God's character. This is a infographic I've put up quite a few times, and we see that, particularly with justification for things like universal salvation, this is very helpful. We see that there's certain elements to God's nature. On one hand, we have truth, and on another hand, we have his grace as well. We have righteousness, judgment, and justice all being part of truth. And then we also have mercy, love, and his omniscience or his all-knowingness as being a gracious thing. And of course, apart from that, he is omnipotent or sovereign as well. And I kind of married that up, I thought, with keeping mercy. If we can reflect that nature of God in our lives, then that's good. If we can hold to judgment or to justice or to righteousness or to truth, or summarize that as truth, and then we wait for God to perform his will in our lives, then I think that's a pretty good thing. And I think this waiting on God continually is nicely summed up in Psalm 16:8. I have set the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I shall not be moved. Bit of a precious promise there, see? But the I kind of thought that that sounded a bit like making God your memorial, see? You know, making God a big thing in your life, always before you. It's almost like a monument in front of you at all times. And of course, taking that humble attitude there that Jacob did, that was another good example there. Genesis 32:10. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. So these verses, great, they reflect this balance that God has between grace and truth. As it says in other places, mercy and truth have met together, righteousness and peace have kissed each other. But Israel have departed. We're going back to Ephraim again. He is a merchant, so he's a businessman. It's just business, don't you know? There's nothing, it's not nothing personal. You know, this is the way that he relates. He doesn't actually get out there and get his hands dirty. He's not the ones doing the crops or anything like that. He is the man, and everybody else is working for him. The balances of deceit, he's a dishonest man, are in his hand, and he loveth to oppress. And I thought this is interesting. Here we have a pride that is embedded into this people, and they're unjust as well. And we have the absence of mercy, almost the opposite of everything that was described before as what we should be aspiring to. And this is what Ephraim says. Yet I am become rich. I have found me out substance. In all my labors they shall find no iniquity in me that was sin. He's self-righteous, isn't he? He's proud and self-righteous. And you know, the problem with a person like that is they're impossible to teach. Even if God was to, you know, turn around and chastise them or whatever, they wouldn't get it because they haven't done anything wrong. Just ask them. You know, like it's the real, you know, this is the big problem. They've got themselves into this. They've hardened their heart. They've not broken up their fallow ground, if I can use a verse from a couple of chapters ago. All right, let's keep going from verse 9. And I that am the Lord thy God from the land of Egypt will yet make thee to dwell in tabernacles. You think you're living in a palace at the moment? Well, you're going to live in a tent. That's basically what he just said. as in the days of the solemn feast. So we know about the Feast of Tabernacles, where the Israelites were commanded to go out and live in tents while this feast was on. And let's keep going in verse 10. I have also spoken by the prophets, and I have multiplied visions and used similitudes by the ministry of the prophets. These are all the things that God has done to try and reach these people. The using of similitudes, I thought, was particularly relevant to Hosea, because his life was a similitude, wasn't it? You know, so he had he was told he was told to marry Gomer, of course, and you know that was a similitude of the relationship between God and his people. All right, let's keep going. Verse 11: Is there iniquity in Gilead? All right, Gilead's up here. Yeah, just so you know. So it's actually Bethel, Shiloh, Gilead. This is all sort of in that Ephraim or that northern kingdom type area. Is there iniquity in Gilead? Surely they are vanity. They sacrifice bullocks in Gilgal. You'll find it on the map. Yea, their altars are as heaps in the furrows of the field. So this was the great sin of Jeroboam. Well, you know, like, remember when the northern kingdom divided off from the southern kingdom? When Jeroboam rebelled against Rehoboam, one of his main concerns was that the people would actually go, oh, we need to go down to Jerusalem and serve God down there. And he's like, if they do that, then they'll just want to, you know, integrate back again with Judah again, you know, become the one tribe again. They'll go off following Rehoboam. And so what he did is he set up all these golden calves at certain convenient spots along the border, and that's what it's talking about. Sacrifice bullocks in Gilgal and having these altars set up. Now, conversely to that, he said, this is not above you in verse 12. It is not above you to dwell in tents. It is not above you to be chased around, because look what happened to Jacob in verse 12. And Jacob fled into the country of Syria, and Israel served for a wife. So Israel, when it's talking about Israel here, this is Jacob's name, of course. He had his name changed. And Israel, of course, means, you know, this prince with God and with men. And so he's saying the prince served for a wife. And for a wife he kept sheep, the lowliest of all takings. We're keeping sheep at the moment. It's a pain in the neck. But that's okay. They're very cute. And okay, let's keep going. 13, and by a prophet the Lord brought Israel out of Egypt, and by a prophet was he preserved. In other words, he's trying to say to them, look, you should be listening to Hosea, you should be listening to these people. Ephraim provoked him to anger most bitterly, therefore shall he leave his blood upon him, and his reproach shall his Lord return unto him. So it ends a bit on a negative note, but there's lots of good stuff in there. Let's stop and have a hymn now, and knowing that we would have a contingent here from other bodies, I'm very. I thought I would pick something with six verses, so we'll sing hymn number 64 to the tune of Eliriah, and it all has to do with the story of Jacob, you may notice. It's very handy. Hymn 64. Thou for whom I inly long, who by faith I now can see, though my company is gone, yet they shall return to me.
Yeah.
Bit of a long one, but a nice one all the same. Like we had some extra voices here today to help out. So, back on that. I thought it was very interesting that this chapter focused a lot on Jacob. And I think the best way to explain the reason why is because in Jacob was found somebody who is worthy of blessing from God. Or, in his own mind, he wasn't worthy. Because as we know, as soon as you think you deserve any sort of mercy, you're not talking about mercy anymore. And I think the thing is that, you know, Jacob obviously was a very humble person. He was a very interesting sort of fellow too. You look at a lot of the things he did and they were quite deceitful. And yet, as it turned out, God turned all of these things around in his life for blessing. At that point where he actually wrestled with the angel, as it says in Genesis 34, and as the hymn talks about, he was in a great amount of stress. He was very, very worried because he thought that his brother, who, of course, he had deceived many years earlier, he thought his brother was going to be coming to kill him. I think he said Esau was coming with either 100 men or 400 men with him. And Jacob thought, that's it, I'm done for. And so he turns and he cries out to God. And he basically adopts this attitude of, he says, well, look, I'm not worthy of any of the things that you've given to me, but turn and deliver me. And what I thought was very interesting is that those that actually find their refuge in God, or those that actually turn to God, or seek the Lord, or remember the Lord, and love the Lord, they're the ones who feel or find the benefit with God. God won't leave them to be left destitute. I was thinking about Psalm 91, where it says, because he hath set his love upon me, therefore will I deliver him. I will set him on high, because he hath known my name. He shall call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. And I thought, you know, that's so beautifully summarizes the situation that Jacob was in with Esau. Now, I thought it was interesting. Isaiah, there is a bit of a common theme in this, I guess, the Old Testament's almost like, much of it's almost like a negotiation. You know, God trying to encourage his people, Israel, to return to him all the time. And I thought it kind of reminded me of this, of some of the verses in Isaiah 30. I've skipped a few just to pull the ones out, which will sort of more align itself, I guess, with Hosea chapter 12. So I'll read them and we'll talk about them. For thus saith the Lord God, the Holy One of Israel, in returning and rest shall you be saved. In quietness and in confidence shall be your strength, and ye would not. I think the thing is God wants us to call on him and to rest in the knowledge that he is God and that he has everything under control. Because it's only through rest, or through having that sort of peace with the knowledge that God has our lives under control, that we can find any sort of comfort in this life, I think. Because if he doesn't have it under control, as so many of these people who don't have God in their life must believe, if he doesn't have it under control, then anything could happen. All the disasters, why wouldn't they happen? You know, there's a good chance they will. You know, and I think the thing is that if you know, once you know that you can take confidence and have quietness in God, then it becomes less about you and more about him and what he's going to do. So let's keep going in verse 18. And therefore will the Lord wait that he may be gracious unto you. And therefore will he be exalted that he may have mercy upon you. For the Lord is a God of judgment. Blessed are all that wait for him. So we see, and I guess there's so many examples in the Old Testament where, despite the fact that Israel have done the wrong thing, he doesn't just march in there with a, you know, an enemy's army and wipe them off the face of the earth straight away. He waits and he waits and he waits, and it's generations upon generations before they, before these people actually receive the judgment that they so justly deserve. And why does he wait? He waits so that we're given the opportunity to turn around, to turn back to him. You know, life, I think, is a bit of a funny thing. It's short, but it's also really long as well. Like, if you consider, you know, I think the older you get, the shorter you think it is. But I think when you consider that, you know, how many days of the week you've got to go to work, and you just go through and you go, you know, you're doing the same thing over and over again. You know, God's waiting all of that time so he can be gracious unto you. He's also exalted. He's praised as the King, as the Omnipotent, so that he can be merciful to us. And if we wait on him, then we will be blessed. Now, Isaiah 30 goes on to talk about a time when the waiting will be over, when all things will come to an end. And it talks about this in verse 26, where it says, "Moreover, the light of the moon shall be as the light of the sun, and the light of the sun shall be sevenfold, as the light of 7 days in the day that the Lord bindeth up the breach of his people and healeth the stroke of their wound." And when you consider it, every person that's born here on the earth has a wound, has a breach, as it says in this King James Version, has a problem. You know, it talks about us being cracked vessels, I guess you could say, or vessels fitted for destruction in other places. And, you know, it's interesting that there is a promise that God will actually bind up these breaches, that he will fix us, that he'll make everything new again. And this time when he's talking about the light of the moon becoming the light of the sun, you know, there's so many different, there's a study in that in itself. You know, this is a time when things will be glorified, when we will be changed. Paul talks about it in 1 Corinthians, you know, and it says that, you know, at the last trump, at the twinkling of an eye, we will be changed. And we will find that the Lord will heal us. We just have to ask for him to do that work in us, and we have to wait for that work to be done. What is so important, I think, in our lives is not to try and rush things. You know, it says it, an ambitious spirit the Lord hateth. You know, the one that is trying to bring about his own redemption, trying to, you know, take control to get into the driver's seat. They're the ones that are going to have the trouble, because you end up driving the wrong direction. And as we saw a couple of weeks back, you know, sometimes the quickest way to go the right direction is to stop and turn around when you've got it all wrong. And so I think really, you know, there is a promise here. There is a promise to us. And I think that one of the great stories of the Bible is the redemption of his people. Now, when you talk to different people, his people means different things. And I think in many ways, Jesus did an amazing thing where he made all of the people in the earth his people. He bought them. He paid their debt. We know he did that. You know, he died once for all. But then we see also this sort of, I guess, side story. If I was some sort of a novelist, you know, somebody who could write stories, you know, quite often the best stories have a major theme, and then they have additional stories that sort of run along, and they all come together at the end in some amazing way. And the Bible's a bit like that. And what we find throughout the Bible is that he has this on and off relationship with his people called Israel. And then it all goes quiet. They're all dispersed. They're exiled. And then we find the New Testament come in, salvation comes to the world, and yet there's these little hints that that other story isn't quite done yet. And so when that other story does come to its grand conclusion, we'll see that that will be the time when the Lord will bind up the breach of the people and heal the stroke of their wound. And we'll see that the light of the moon will become as the light of the sun, and the light of the sun as sevenfold. As I said, there's a bit of a study in that. It's perhaps not one from the pulpit, though. All right. Well, I think I've said enough this morning. So we're actually going to get out early, which is like never happens here. So so I'll ask the worship band to come up and we'll sing one more song, Have Faith in God.
Thanks, Ben. So if you'd all like to stand up, we'll sing our last song, Have Faith in God.
Everyone for coming this morning. It's certainly been a bit of an amazing chapter, I think. Good old Hosea 12. Not one that you sort of look at just glance through and think, oh, there's so much in this. But then when you start looking into it, of course, you find that there is, as we so often find. So the verse for this week, of course, Hosea 12:6. Therefore, turn thou to thy God, keep mercy and judgment, and wait on the Lord, thy God, continually. The Lord will work too. All right. A special thanks to our guest pianist this morning. Did famously. And have a lovely week, and we'll see you all again next week.